10:30 in Melbourne. You're with John Yost. John.
Thanks, Mike. Well, we're now going to talk about UFOs. I've got Paul Norman with me. Paul Norman is the Vice President of the Victorian UFO Research Society. His visit, I guess, is provoked by the fact that it's the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of Cessna pilot Fred de Valentich, who disappeared 10 years ago in his plane over Bass Strait. Always an amazing UFO case. You may recall that this guy was talking about being buzzed by UFOs just before he went off air. And, of course, no trace has ever been found since. Well, welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
You've been looking at the phenomena of UFOs for 35 years.
Now, that's correct.
It's funny that the UFO phenomena really does seem to start around the 1940s.
Well, it was started before that. During World War II, they were called Foo Fighters. At that time, the Allied intelligence officers thought they belonged to the Axis powers, and the Axis powers thought they belonged to the Allies. After the war, when they realized it belonged to neither side, then they set up investigation projects, some of the governments, but unfortunately, these investigations have been carried on in secrecy, with officials speaking from both sides of the mouth. When they're speaking to the public, they're treated as nonsense. When they're speaking their own commands, they're treated as serious business.
Well, I'll tell you something very interesting. I've told this story on radio before, so I'll tell it very quickly. I once got myself involved in a UFO hoax, and we perpetuated a hoax, which was accepted by the media. This is about 20 years ago. Probably irresponsible of us, but, you know, boys will be boys. And the next day, the RAF put out a statement saying it was weather balloons, which did make me think. You know, I knew that it was a hoax, and so why would the RAF put out a statement saying it was weather balloons? Well, now, I'm not saying I believe in UFOs, but I do. It's an indication that they were certainly sensitive to it, and they came up with a story to explain our hoax.
That's right. Well, about 85% are mistaken identities, only about 5% hoaxes, but we have access to stress analysis equipment, and we also have access to photo computer analysis, high-tech, and the hoax cases are easy to break down. Our main problem is mistaken identities. Of the 15% people ring in, they see a balloon and they think it's a UFO or a satellite or space junk, but we sort those out at the telephone. It boils down to about 15%, about one out of five is worth follow-up, and even some of them, a lot of them break down when you get to checking it out.
When Jimmy Carter ran for the presidency, I think that he made a promise to open the file that the U.S. government had on UFOs. Is that correct?
That's correct. Two or three of the ex-presidents have made that statement, but when they get to actually get to be president, a lot of things they're not allowed to talk about.
Well, it's extraordinary that somebody would back off, make a promise, and then not deliver on it. It might relate to this. There's been a rumor floating around the media for years, and of course various UFO books, etc., about a UFO that's supposed to have crashed in the 1940s, and that the U.S. government holds the wreckage of the aircraft and their bodies in Nevada.
Yeah, that's correct. I know three of the scientists working on that case. I know about the story, and they have documents on that and trying to get more. And I think there will be an congressional investigation on that case. Now, I know of the story. I've never seen it myself.
Do you believe it?
Well, I'm on the borderline. I'm not sure about that. I deal with cases with tangible evidence that I know myself. But I have an open mind on this case.
What about people who say they've met visitors?
Well, there again, that's usually taken care of by psychologists who are doing hypnosis with people. That's out of my field.
Well, it sort of relates, I suppose, to the case we had last year, or two cases we've had it recently in the Nullarbor Plain. The Null family had their car picked up, and allegedly by some sort of UFO, and then it was dropped 200 yards later. And then most recently we had a case last week of somebody being buzzed in the same area around Eucla in South Australia, I think.
Well, we interviewed the Knowles family when they got to Melbourne, and Faye Knowles, who had reached on top and felt something and with the dust on her arm. By the time she got to, they got to Melbourne, her arm was swelling, and they thought they were going 200 k's to get out from under whatever it was. But this this car, the driver insisted he was going 200 k's, the full scale of the speedo. Well, that car, of course, won't do 200 k's on the ground. They didn't realize they were in the air till it was dropped. So a colleague, John Ocketill, and I went to Adelaide when they got the car there, and we jacked up the front wheels. It's the front wheel drive, and the wheels will spin at full scale. That is documented by video, Channel 7.
What about the residue material found
I took the samples of that dust back to the United States and gave it to a retired NASA scientist who has he has contacts all over the world. He submitted it to the Phillips Laboratory for analysis, and it was not brake dust like they had said it was. It was carbon, oxygen, silicon. The strangest thing is there's a possibility that it's astatine. They're still checking on these particles, not only at that university or that laboratory, but the other. Now, astatine is very very scarce on the Earth. It was first produced synthetically by three scientists at one of the universities in California. They bombarded bismuth with helium nuclei particles, and they produced synthetic astatine. But it has a life of about 7 or 8 hours once the reaction takes place. And by the time the car got to, was it Sedona? Yes, Sedona, where it was checked out for the first time for radiation by the police, naturally there wasn't any indication of it. This was a strange part of the case.
How often you hear of depressions in farm in the country? Depressions will be found in a field, there'll be scorching around it. Often there is calcification as though there's been intense temperature, etc. How often do you come across phenomena like that?
Well, we have quite a few cases. I have pictures of some of them, and there again we have submit these samples from the center of the edge and the control 100 feet away. It's checked out by what they call a thermoluminescence test. And on some cases, it's been found where the soil had been heated with something higher than sunlight or something like that. And one interesting case up at near Sale, 1980, it rained and the water stood in the circle in like beads of mercury or oil, which indicated that the composition of the soil had changed. Those sort of cases. There are a lot of those circles found in Australia, but most of the times no one has seen a UFO, and we check them out if it seems to be interested. But several cases where there's actually UFO has been seen sitting there.
Where do you think they come from, if they're there? I mean, I'm not saying I don't know what to make of it, frankly. Somebody suggested to me that UFOs are part of that we invent new myths. We always have to have myths, and that UFOs are part of the sort of the 20th century process of creating our own 20th century mythology.
Well, I wouldn't know whether, whence or why, and I'd have to have tangible evidence to make a statement. But I do know that they are operating on a technology far beyond their own. They have complete control over gravity. They affect, one of the main characteristics is they affect ignition systems, radio, TV when they're nearby, power blackouts. In fact, Frederick Valentich, who was on his trip, he reported his engine coughing and rough idling when the thing was close to him. That's a natural, characteristic of UFOs when they're close to these things.
Do you think they may have abducted him, or do you think he crashed into the sea? They killed him, in other words.
Valentich, after this sound, it interrupted transmission. He started to say Melbourne something. After that, we don't know whether it went up or down or disintegrated. But the interesting thing is we compare his cases with, we got 19 others. We have a case of a helicopter pilot and flying over Howe for a crew. And they first saw that there was a tower light, a beacon light on a tower, but the crew chief notified the pilot that they were approaching, and he saw it was on a collision course. And Larry Cohen, in his name, from Cleveland, he put the helicopter in decline, and this thing came. They were going 100 knots, and this thing took up a position just ahead, which meant it went along at their speed. And this time he was wondering how close he was to the ground. He looked down to his altimeter. He thought he was around 1,700 feet. To his amazement, he was climbing to 3,500 feet in a matter of minutes. And there was a bump and a thud, and he broke loose from whatever it was, and went on to his destination. But the thing is, he was describing the same sort of object that Valentius was describing: the green light, the maneuverability, and the shape is a cigar shape, long shape, metallic appearance, including a green light, which Valentius was reporting moments before the radio transmission. Well, since the Knowles family car, something on it, we actually know that it was in the air, the indications are.
Well, there's another case that was very interesting, made a big burst of publicity, involved a television journalist, Quentin Fogarty,
yes,
who was flying, I think, over near New Zealand somewhere, and their plane got buzzed, and they filmed it, and the sort of film of these lights. Now, Quentin Fogarty, I know, is not a crank. He's a very straight, hard-working journalist who, I suppose, is in some ways severely embarrassed by the experience he had, because probably damaged his credibility to even say that it had happened. And yet, I know he would never have made it up. I know he's a very credible man.
Well, a scientist did computer analysis on those frames. There were about 3,000 frames, and it was an unknown. The problem in this field, there are too many people talking about it who don't know anything about it. You had about 18 different explanations of the Quentin Fogarty case coming from all over the world, all contradicting and unsatisfactory, coming from armchair experts who had never investigated. But Dr. Bruce McAbee, he's a photophysicist in the United States. He was the chief investigator of that case, and there were 20 scientists on the investigation. 3,000 frames, and it's a genuine case.
And no one really came up with any explanation other than that it was an unidentified flying object.
Unidentified UFO. Unidentified.
Well, are they... I mean, you must have a few... I know you take the engine... I know you're an engineer. In fact, the Herald reports you as running a fire station in Tennessee when you first saw a UFO back in 1946 or whenever. Of course, you're not a... you're an engineer running a Tennessee power station. But we always make mistakes like that, and I make plenty myself, so I'm not attacking the Herald. But clearly you have that sort of engineer's approach to it. There's no room for romance. You're only interested in facts. But you must have some opinions. Now, do you think they're from outer space, or do you think that perhaps they're from here?
Well, I know... I don't know the whether, whence, and why, as I mentioned, but there's no scientists on Earth. Well, the scientists today, the vast majority, will say the maneuvers and operations they're doing, it's against the laws of physics, which is identical to the statement they were making back at the turn of the century when they were saying that the airplane was impossible because it's against the laws of physics. 2 weeks after the first flight of 150 feet, the leading scientific journal of the day was still giving reasons it couldn't be done. Science is not always reality.
Science deals with the
known.
I'm
inclined to think they're from elsewhere, because there are no scientists on Earth that I know about will brush it off. We do have a small percentage helping us out on the analysis, like this dust and other.
There are a little bit of physical evidence.
Yes.
Is there a changing? Are the nature of sightings and experiences with UFOs changing, or are they basically the same as they were back in the 1940s?
Characteristics like the physical effects they have on people, the electromagnetic effects, the cattle stock in a panic. There is more attention paid to these cases where hypnosis is being used. People who claim that they have been abducted, and there's more hypnosis going on to try to determine.
Well, I was glad to talk to you today because I had in last week with Lee Strieber, who's written an author, a book, he's an author, and he's actually been quite a, you know, his publishing career has been very successful. He's a respected author in the United States, and he's sort of, I guess, damaged his own credibility by writing a book called Communion, which is about his experiences, alleged experiences with aliens, or whatever. He doesn't know whether they're aliens, whether he's imagined it, or whether they're from some sort of hidden spiritual civilization that exists on Earth. And it's pretty way out sort of stuff. But nevertheless, he strikes me as being a very credible man, and a man who's would much rather have not have had the experience. But that's the other sort of the UFO experience, and we are hearing a bit about that sort of thing. And I wonder what you make of that.
Well,
how much have you talked to people?
Yes, I have. I've never put them under hypnosis. I'm not in that field, but I've talked to the ones that have been hypnotized, and we are paying more attention to these cases, like taking as example the helicopter case. Was that attempted abduction? Was the Knowles family case attempted abduction? And that is the 14th case we know about where the cars have been lifted. Of course, there might be others that we never heard of. It leads us to wonder, was the Valentich a successful one? But as I mentioned, I must go with tangible evidence. After this sound, we don't know whether it went up or down or disintegrated.
Well, have you ever seen, you have seen one yourself, apart from the experience you had 35 years ago when you saw a disc-shaped object which was moving around a bit like a helicopter. And then took off at a great speed, which is, again, seems to me a classic pattern. Have you seen anything since?
Yes, I saw two, but that's what got me interested that first, and I started paying attention to reports. After that, I saw two more after that, but it was up in northern Victoria around Leechville when they were having a period of activity up there. Well, every man and his brother was reporting UFO sightings. I set out myself 15 nights. And I did see two, but they were at a distance, and there was erratic moving light. It was doing figure eights, circles, and all this. That's all I could say about it. But these night lights are very difficult. There's not much detail you can get. For example, we have a lot of pictures of globs of light. You photograph an airplane at a distance, you only get a glob of light with the airplane. That doesn't mean there's nobody there, because
sure,
it could be 400 people. Well, the same thing. The difference in the UFO is these erratic movements they have. Do all sorts of stunts.
They seem to be mischievous, don't they?
Yes. The best daytime reports come from airline pilots. And almost invariably, daytime, they are dull silver or aluminum color. And we think they have a glow about them like your wristwatch. It doesn't show up until it's dark. That's a theory, but we think that.
Well, I actually met an airline pilot who was going from Sydney to Melbourne, who was following another plane of a different. One was ANSET, one was TAA, and he heard the TAA or the ANSET people, whoever it was, talking on radio about a UFO. He's convinced, that was convinced him. He didn't actually see it, but he heard the pilots in the plane, which were a couple, you know, how they always fly down Sydney to Melbourne at the same time, no doubt to help the market out. Suits the customer to all fly at the same time. But the one in front had this experience, and he heard them talking about it on the radio, but nothing ever came of it. But it's sort of interesting. I've got a caller here, Bob, on the line, who's got a comment about the Valentich case. Hello, Bob.
Hello, John.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, we were down the southern coast of Victoria, down at Trek Lip Trap, which is pretty close to Wilson's Promontory there, and we found some strips of aluminium tangled up into the rock. So they looked like the leading edges of a plane. They were curved with rivets, you know, 3 or 4 feet long, and there were about sort of, I suppose, 3 or 4 feet, 3 or 4 pieces of them. A couple of them had plywood pop riveted to them. But the one piece that sort of looked like the leading edge of a wing, up one end of it, it was completely melted and twisted, you know. It reminded us of, you know, something had really been hot and burnt one end of it. The other end was okay. And, you know, I often thought that it could have been something to do with that Valantage case, but I didn't pick them up and carry them, you know, back with us because they were so far from the car.
Caught it?
Sorry?
Did you report it?
I didn't report it, no, because, you know, it's one of those sort of things you think, you go back and say something, who do you report it to? The police, and they say, oh, yeah, and, you know, you never hear any more about it. But, you know, I've often thought about it, and when your show was on just then, it reminded me again.
Well, it's a bit of a mystery, isn't it?
Yes, I wondered how it could be melted so much. This aluminium was really, really hot and just in, you know, as if it's been in a furnace, but the other end was completely, you know, nice and curved and clean.
Well, aluminium, have you got a comment on that, Bob?
Yes.
I'm sorry, on yeah. Paul.
We're in direct contact with the leading scientists who are taking interest in this subject, and anything like that is found, if you'll send it to this post office box, we're sure you will put it in the top scientists in their hands, and they have access to all sorts of laboratories.
Yeah, well, I'll get the name out. Paul Norman. It's the International. It's the the Victorian UFO Research Society. Post Office Box Moorabbin, Victoria 3189. Post Office Box Moorabbin, Victoria 3189. And Paul Norman's the man to write to if you have an experience. Always interested in hearing from people who have come into contact with UFOs.
We will keep their name confidential if they so desire.
Okay, Paul, well, thank you very much for coming today. It's one of life's mysteries. As you can talk around in circles, and you'll never get anywhere. I don't know what to make of it myself, but I guess there's something there. Lots of people believe in it now, anyway.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, Paul Norman, who's the Vice President of the Victorian UFO Research Society. We're in today, and remembering Fred Valantage, the pilot who disappeared with his Cessna over Bass Strait after saying he was being buzzed by a UFO, and it's 10 years ago, almost to the day.
8 minutes to 11, currently 15 degrees.
We're celebrating, I don't think that's quite the right term actually, we're acknowledging this month, in fact tomorrow, the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of Fred Valantage, the disappearance of he and his Cessna over Bass Strait. The disappearance, as we all know, I think, has become one of the great post-war mysteries, what actually happened. There's a solid body of thought, including his family, which is quite convinced that a UFO, an unidentified flying object, was involved in Valantage's disappearance in some way. And as I say, it's 10 years tomorrow since it all happened. So in the studio tonight, I have with me a 70-year-old man by the name of Paul Norman. He'll be familiar to those of you who are interested in UFOs. He's made it really his life mission, researching UFO cases around the world. He is obviously a believer in UFOs, and although he does admit that there have been a lot of frauds. He's Vice President of the UFO Research Society here in Victoria. Paul Norman, good evening, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Now, let's start with the Valantage case, because it's 10 years tomorrow. Let's recap. What do you say happened?
Well, he was on his way to King Island to get crayfish, and soon after he left the lighthouse vicinity at the Cape Otway, he thought he saw an airplane in the area, and he inquired to the traffic controller, who informed him that there was no traffic in the area. But as the object came closer, he saw that it wasn't. He saw that it was a long shape, a metallic appearance, and it had a maneuverability that he couldn't estimate the speed, and he reported his engine coughing or idling, like this electromagnetic effect, which is a characteristic of a UFO throughout the world when they're close to ignition system, radio, TV. And one of his last statements was this strange object was hovering over him, and it was not an aircraft. And there was a mystery sound that interrupted the transmission, and right. after that, we don't know what happened. He started to say Melbourne something, and then this sound that's never been explained.
Now, this conversation, of course, with Control was taped. Do you believe we've heard all the tape?
I think we have. The Department of Transport never did release the sound portion of the tape,
no.
although they gave the transcript.
Yeah.
And the father listened to the tape to identify his son's voice, whether it was, and he seems to think that it was all there.
Now, you're not just convinced that it was a UFO in his case because of what was said, because you believe that there have been other cases, don't you? Similar, very similar to this.
That's correct. We compared this with other cases. We have a case of a helicopter pilot over Ohio who was describing the same sort of an object that Valentich was describing. Maneuverability, long shape, with a green light that Federick was describing.
Well, Mr. Norman, you've brought in a tape of yeah. some of the conversation. Now, this is between the helicopter pilot and who?
This was the helicopter pilot telling
yeah.
about his experience. Not about him, his experience.
It's him talking about what he
that's
saw.
That's right.
All right, let's have him do a couple of minutes of it, and then we'll comment on it afterwards.
Trained military personnel with thousands of hours of flying time behind them. What occurred next might seem like science fiction, but it happened.
I last looked at my altimeter, we were 1,700 feet. Then this craft began to move slowly to the west, away from us. At this time, I was worried we were going to hit the ground. And I looked at my altimeter, and our helicopter was 3,500 feet, climbing 1,000 feet a minute with no changes in the control. We went from 1,700 feet to 3,500 feet in a matter of seconds and never knew it. The helicopter topped out at 3,800 feet and there was a bump like turbulence, at which time we had control of the aircraft again. I had control and we took it back down to 2,500 feet. Good, then we continued on to Cleveland. As far as the vehicle itself, there's no doubt in our mind what it looked like, a craft that could move with terrific speeds in excess of 1,000 knots and then stop on a dime. It maintains altitude, can change altitude, climb, descend, to encounter a UFO. When it does approach the aircraft, you have no idea what it is. Well, I think if it wanted to collide with us, it could have. Well, you can't get away from it. You don't have that much time to respond.
All right, now that's some of the description there by the Ohio helicopter pilot, who obviously survived the experience.
A four-man crew. They yep. got back to tell about their experience, and Frederick Valentich did not.
Right. Now, but what is the similarities there between that tape and Valentich?
Well, we have wondered, especially since some of these other cases, like the Knowles car being picked up and all that, was this sound, the sound latching on to the aircraft? And his description with 19 other descriptions, they all seem to harmonize with each other.
Mm. Because you say there are about 20 such cases similar to Frederick Valentich's.
Yes, some of them we know they have crashed, and others that just disappeared. We don't know whether went up or down or disintegrated. We know of one case that actually disintegrated the plane when a UFO was nearby. In fact, it had fired on the UFO.
All right. Now, well, the obvious question to this and the general sort of question, I suppose, arising out of all these cases, I mean, why do these UFOs only seem to come in sort of isolated cases where someone like Fred Valentich is seemingly on his own, away from other people? I mean, why doesn't a UFO land in the city square here in Melbourne and say, well, here we are?
Well, I'd have to know what the motive is before I could answer that. I don't know the whither, whence, and why, but there have been hundreds of people see them at the time around the cities in those areas, but these strange cases are taking place in isolated areas where they come down on the ground and do these things. We don't know why that is.
Because that's what creates the problem where people say, well, I don't say, they say, well, I don't believe Paul Norman, I don't believe Frederick Bilentic said. I mean, why can't we just say, well, look, Frederick Bilentic, unfortunately, crashed his plane in Bass Strait?
Well, there wasn't anything floating in what he was describing, what the other people had said. There's some theory. One of the theories is that they gradually reveal in their presence, so we won't have a culture shock. That's speculation. I don't know. But we do know that they don't like to be public. These strange cases are taking place in isolated areas.
The UFOs don't like to be too public.
Well, that's just... obviously, they're not. What their motive would be, I wouldn't know.
Now, you have seen a UFO.
Yes, that's what got me interested back in 1953. I saw an object. I was superintendent of a power station.
Whereabouts was this?
This was in Tennessee.
Right.
And I was called outside to see what it was. I thought it was a nice, fine helicopter. It's approaching, coming up the river below the power station, about the speed of a helicopter. And when it got over the station, it stopped for about a half minute, and then it sped away. It was as fast, at least as fast as a jet, with no sound.
How big was it, about the size of a helicopter? Or bigger than that?
I'd say it was a circular object. It's just an estimate. I would say it was about 30 feet in diameter.
Did it have lights?
Yes, a whitish blue light, blinking on, off, pulsating about once a second, changed dim, bright.
Mm-hmm. And were you scared when this happened?
No, I was awestruck. Right.
Mm-hmm. And were you scared when this happened?
No, I was awestruck. I was astonished. No, I wasn't scared. In fact, I thought that, perhaps the wind is blowing the sound away from me. And when I saw it in November in Tennessee, that's wintertime, of course, I went out and got the tip end of the blades of grass, dry grass, flipped it up, and what a little breeze it was going my way.
And yet there was no sound.
I didn't hear no sound, but people that have been near them, they report a sound similar to a humming transformer and some swishing sound sometime, but they have to be very close to these objects.
Now, also, when all this happened to you, I mean, did you say to yourself, oh, look, you know, Paul, don't be stupid, you know, there's some physical explanation of this, there's some sort of funny lighting or star system?
I tried to think of all this, but then I started paying attention to the reports, started interviewing people. The best reports come from airline pilots. Daytime sightings, that is. And invariably in the daytime, they're a dull silver or aluminum color. We think that they possibly have something like your wristwatch dial on your wristwatch. It doesn't track the attention until after dark. You don't see this light. However, that is only a theory.
Once this has happened to you, and then you noticed other reports, and you felt, God, there's similarities between what I saw and heard. Now, did you actually report your specific sighting? Did you try and report your case to anybody?
I told the people I work with. I was telling them about, there were several reports along about that time. And that same month, there was a pilot, two airmen disappeared while they were... investigating a UFO case. It happened at near Kinross Air Force Base in Michigan. The object was first detected by radar, and they had one interceptor at the base, and they scrambled it. They reported this object, and as they got closer to it, at first there was a lot of static on the radio, and then it faded altogether. But the radar... they had the blip of the UFO on the radar and the blip of the interceptor approaching. And when they merged, the two blips merged for about 20 seconds. And then they took off. They searched the area like Bill Indich for about 3 weeks. Nothing was ever found. Nothing was ever found. Well, little did I dream back November 1953 that I'd involved in the greatest mystery in Australian aviation history.
And of course you've spent, since that time, 1953, you spent most of your years traveling around the world looking at...
No, I was in the power stations until 1976, doing this part-time.
Right.
But after that, I opted for early retirement to do it this full-time.
It's become an obsession.
Well, some people say compulsion, some obsession, depending on whether my friend or foe.
Because, I'm sure you've been called, a nut and a crank by many people. How do you react to that?
Well, that doesn't bother me. These usually come from people that don't know what's going on. The real little green men are humans who are so green, in fact, they don't realize something's going on that they don't understand. They are the real little green men. As far as green men from outer space, I've been investigating now for 35 years. And I know investigators, personally acquainted investigators all over the world, and I never heard of one case of a little green man. The only little green men I know are humans who so green they don't realize something is going on that they don't understand.
All right, now can we move our attention to the situation, I think it was out in the Nullarbor, the family that came from Perth and were coming to Melbourne by car. This is earlier this year. I think you went out there to have a look at their car, didn't you?
Yes, when it got to Adelaide, we went out and we interviewed the family.
So the Knowles family, was it?
The Knowles family.
Yes, that's right.
When they got to Melbourne. And Faye Knowles, who had reached on top with her arm covered
yes,
with dust.
That's right.
By the time she got to Melbourne, her arm was swelling, and I suspected it was some sort of temporary radiation. But a colleague and I, John Ocketell, we went out to examine the car when it got to Adelaide, and the driver, he thought he was doing 200 Ks to get out from under the object. He didn't realize he was in the air till it dropped back, and he reported 200 Ks, his speedo full scale. Of course, that car won't go 200 Ks on the ground, but what we did was check up the front wheels when we got out there. It's a front wheel drive, and those wheels will spin at 200 Ks full scale, which tied in precisely as what he said.
So you believe that?
That was documented by Channel 7.
That's right. Now, you believe that family, you believe it was a UFO?
It all ties in, and I took the dust. I took the dust samples, and we vacuumed him out of the car back to the States with him, and a retired scientist from NASA had submitted it to the Phillips Laboratory.
Right.
High technology laboratory, and it was not brake dust. And
but what was it?
Well, among other things, oxygen, silicon, but the most interesting part was the indication that it could have been astatine. Now, astatine has a half life when it's first split up atomic elements. For example, it was first synthetically produced in California University by bombarding bismuth with helium nuclei. And when that action takes place, it's slightly radioactive, but it has a half-life of 7 or 8 hours. And by the time they had got to Sedona, and where it was checked by the police for radiation, naturally it would have been decayed. But I've recently found, after I went back there, I found another gentleman who went to that area about an hour after it happened and picked up a sort of fiber stuff on it. About a quarter of a mile it spread it along the highway. And between his fingers it crumbled in something that resembled, some sort of graphite, but right. It was so light the wind was blowing it away. And 1 week later, it's important, he broke out the same symptoms as Faye Knowles, only he was admitted to the hospital a few days later. And we're trying to now to get the two doctors together with his permission to try to determine if this is what happened.
Well, it's a strange case. So is Frederick Valentik. Well, the whole thing is just fascinating. I just wish we just knew a little bit more, but that's what you've dedicated the rest of your life to finding out more about UFOs. Now, you're interested in people getting in touch with you, want to either talk to you about various things that they might have seen, ask you whether, in fact, they may have seen UFOs, or, in fact, join your society. So your box number is, if people want to contact you, P.O. Box Moorabbin.
We will keep their names confidential if they so desire.
All right, so if they've got any queries about it, or if they want to belong to the society, or if they've had an experience which they feel you should know something about. Well, how are you... Well, tomorrow is not really celebration day, is it? Well, how will you spend tomorrow?
I'm on the telephone talking to other people, and we've got calls coming in pretty often now where I am about the case, asking questions about it.
Mm. 10 years tomorrow since Frederick Valentik disappeared. All right, Paul Norman, thank you very much indeed for coming in tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.